The presidency of Donald Trump has sent shockwaves through the politics and culture, not just of the United States, but of the whole world. That's not surprising, considering how unprecedented Trump was as a candidate and so far as a president. What has been more surprising, though, at least for people who thought Trump's election betokened an end stage in the dumbing down of America, is that the Trump phenomenon has been a boon for book publishing. True, some of Trump's own books, notably The Art of the Deal, are big hits once again, but landmark books about totalitarianism and public dystopias have vaulted to the highest rungs of the bestseller lists, alongside the contemporary breed of dystopian fiction that has so gripped teenagers and millennials. The feeling is that Trump may not be completely unprecedented. He may have been prefigured in great books that warned of the appeal of demagogues and their cunning ability to lead masses from democracy to tyranny. And so we look to great fiction and nonfiction to understand how we got here, and perhaps find a roadmap to what lies ahead among them. George Orwell's 1984, written in 1949, a bleak vision of a totalitarian society defined by surveillance, thought control, and relentless propaganda. Sales of 1984 soared when Trump spokesperson Kellyanne Conway uttered the Orwellian expression, alternative facts. Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here from 1935 is the story of a populist demagogue named Berzelius Buzz Windrup, who is elected to the White House and proceeds to impose fascist rule while political moderates and liberals look on haplessly. It is now being revived on stage. Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, 1985, is a novel about a puritanical, patriarchal theocracy called Gilead, coming to power in New England, stripping women of any rights and reducing them to servants and childbearing chattel. It has been an opera, a ballet, a film, a graphic novel, and now adapted for television as a miniseries on Bravo. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World from 1931 told the story of a totalitarian future dystopia in the year 2540, in which people are happily enslaved by a steady diet of drugs, escapist entertainment, and sex. And perhaps most surprisingly, considering it's a rather arduous read, Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, her 1951 tome analyzing the role of anti-Semitism, propaganda, political lies, and appeals to the masses that made Nazism and Stalinism possible. We're going to talk about these books this morning and how well they describe and perhaps predicted Donald Trump and the peculiar political moment we are living in. Sally Perry is a professor of English at Illinois State University and the executive director of the Sinclair Lewis Society. She is in a studio in Normal, Illinois this morning. Roger Berkowitz is an associate professor of politics, human rights, and philosophy. He's the founder and academic director of Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities at Bard College in Annandale-on-Hudson in New York State. That's where he is this morning. And with me in Toronto, Margaret Atwood needs little introduction, given that she's Canada's best-known writer. In addition to The Handmaid's Tale, she has written dozens of other works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. She has won numerous national and international awards for her work. Her latest book is the graphic novel Angel Catbird. Welcome, everybody. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
You laughed when I said your
book. I did.
Book.
Yeah, I thought you said Angel Cat Burger. That is not the title.
I should go on the radio,
We're
I guess.
We're not there yet, yes.
I need a working definition of dystopian literature. What is a dystopian novel or work of art? Is it fantasy literature? Is it science fiction? Professor Perry, what do you think?
I think that a dystopian literature is that which presents a society which seems absolutely horrible, whether it's a theocracy or a bad political arrangement. You know, some might think that we're currently living in a dystopia. But of course, you know, the other side of that is what's a dystopia for one person is a utopia for somebody else.
Ms. Atwood,
yes.
What do you think?
Sci-fi and speculative fiction can be either dystopic or utopic. But utopias and dystopias are joined at the hip in that every dystopia contains a little utopia, and every utopia, when you start digging, contains a little dystopia. They're both blueprints of something we don't have yet, but could have should we continue down this or that path.
And supplementary to that, you've said that anything can happen anywhere in any given circumstances.
Yeah, well, anything human can happen to any society given the circumstances. So we're not immune. I think that's the message.
Roger Berkowitz, what about dystopia as far as you're concerned? And Hannah Arendt.
Well, I mean, a dystopia is a disordered place, like a utopia is a place that's nowhere. I agree with Ms. Atwood that one of the things that we should always be aware of is that all of these things are possible. We think of utopias as places that are not possible, and they're probably less possible than dystopias. But I think dystopias are popular and important because they provide fear. And I think the memory of bad things that have happened in the past, be it the Holocaust or totalitarianism or the gulags, is generally not going to create the kind of experience mediated over generations that's going to prevent it from happening again. The best protection we have against it from happening again is real fear. And I think in that way, dystopian novels are very important.
Are you surprised that Hannah Arendt's work it's become a bestseller decades after her death?
I think she would be shocked. You know, there's a famous story that Isaiah Berlin said when she died that she was an overrated journalist who would be forgotten immediately. And that hasn't happened. You know, she was someone who wrote cross genres and didn't ever have a full-time academic position or a tenured position anywhere. But I think her work is unique in that it brings an incredible philosophical and literary erudition, humanist erudition, to real problems in the world. And because she looks at them so originally, and she really is one of the most original and unique thinkers in the canon, she constantly allows us to look at everyday problems differently. At a time when people are struggling to do that, when there's so much groupthink, yeah. If you want to use that word. She's not liberal. She's not conservative. She's hard to put any kind of box. But because she thinks, people find her bracing and relevant today.
The Handmaid's Tale. I had forgotten you started writing in 1984.
That's true.
Was that a coincidence?
It was a coincidence, but a meaningful one, because
indeed,
think of how very, very old I am. So I was of an age to have read 1984 as a young teenager, which I did. I still have my copy of it with quite a cheesy sort of drugstore cover on it.
Right.
You know, girl with lots of cleavage on the front and people leering at her. So, but that was how they sold classic books in those days. And Brave New World I read at the same time, just about all of H.G. Wells and Ray Bradbury as he was coming out. And Hannah Arendt somewhat later when I was at college.
But you were living in Berlin
in 1984.
When you were writing Handmaid's Tale.
The wall was still there.
So on the one hand, you had Ronald Reagan and the moral majority, and on the other hand, you had the Stasi.
I did, yes. And I went across to East Berlin and Czechoslovakia and Poland. Quite different places. Poland was much more wide open, but it was still a matter of who do you trust, who do you talk to, where do you talk to them, considering the fact that your car, your house, your hotel room may all be bugged. So I wasn't threatened. I wasn't about to be arrested, but the people I was talking to had to be pretty careful.
Did you incorporate those sensations and those elements into the novel?
Of course. And when we launched the film in 1990, it was just as the wall was coming down, and we launched it in both West and East Berlin. And in East Berlin, they looked at it very intently, and then they said, this was our life. They didn't mean the theocracy and the outfits. They meant you didn't know who you could trust. And now that we've opened the Stasi files, we know how very, very true that was.
You said that it was not a predictive novel. It was an anti-predictive
novel.
What is that? What do you mean by
that? Well, you write these kinds of books in the hopes that they will not happen.
Yeah,
so I was looking at a lot of newspapers and magazines and clipping them at the time, and people were already talking in 1984-5. The right was already talking about what they would like to do should they have the opportunity. And now they have.
Sally Perry, it can't happen here, the Sinclair Lewis. He was married to Dorothy Thompson, the journalist, who had interviewed Hitler and Mussolini.
Mm-hmm.
Did that spark he wanted to get the novel done? He wanted to write that?
Oh, very much. Lewis traveled quite a bit throughout Europe in the early 30s, and his marriage to Dorothy Thompson, I think, really spurred his interest in political problems in the United States. I mean, It Can't Happen Here was written in a white heat in about 2 months.
Wow.
And I know it was amazing. And, you know, it's not perfectly formed, but it's so passionate about the fear of what could happen. And, you know, over and over again, he heard about American exceptionalism. Well, you know, it happens in other countries, in Germany, in Italy, wherever, but it can't happen here. And he wanted to show that it was really possible. And, you know, you think of people like Huey Long, for example, or Father Coughlin, who were actually, you know, their voices were incorporated into the novel because they were talking about the things he was writing about.
When you were watching the campaign last year, did the thought cross your head that, wait a minute, this election is starting to look a lot like what Sinclair Lewis was talking about?
Well, it certainly did, especially when the convention ended up in Cleveland, just as it did in It Can't Happen Here.
Yes, that's right.
Which is kind of frightening. And, you know, I think that there's also a sort of a comparison because Donald Trump, despite the fact that he has so much money, was speaking to the people that sort of identified as being forgotten or being sort of ignored. And Buzz Windrip in the novel is speaking to that exact same constituency. He, you know, a lot of his followers are called the Forgotten Men. And, you know, this was in the depth of the Depression. But you can certainly see a correlation between those two groups of basically unemployed or underemployed white men who felt that the country had passed them by.
Windrip is described as a vulgar, almost illiterate public liar who represents the Forgotten Man. And complains about the lies in the mainstream press.
Mm.
That's rather close to home, isn't it?
Sadly, yes. And everybody says, well, aren't they the same? And I said, well, you know, one of the things that's obviously different is that Windrip in the novel has sort of a paramilitary organization called the Minutemen. And, you know, and, you know, obviously there's an appeal to patriotism and whatnot there. And I'm glad to see that the courts in this country are staying very strong and trying to deal with the rule of law rather than the rule of the tweet.
You teach Handmaid's Tale to your students. Do they see it more timely now and relevant, perhaps more so than they did formerly?
You know, they've always liked it. I tend to teach Handmaid's Tale and It Can't Happen Here every time there's a presidential election.
Really? Every 4 years?
They make a wonderful pair. And, you know, the one time I did it, I guess it was when Ross Perot was the third party candidate, everybody in my class went out and registered to vote.
Roger Berkowitz, in teaching Hannah Arendt, you find that the students are now more tuned in to the origins of totalitarianism? Are they more engaged with it?
You know, it's a text that engages them on many different levels. When I started I teach a whole course on the book, and I sort of framed it around the questions of human rights. There's a very famous chapter on it where Arendt is, on the one hand, critical of the human rights tradition, and on the other hand, attempting to think about what it would mean to build a philosophically meaningful idea of human rights. But today, one of the real themes of the book, in fact, I think the main theme of the book, is that the root of totalitarianism is in a kind of existential loneliness that pervades a modern society that doesn't have sort of its rootedness in traditions and home and family and religions and other things, and that this leads to the rise of movements. And the book is really about the danger and the formation and the way that movements work and then the way they can take power.
And she talked about pan movements. What did she mean by that?
Well, pan movements were two particular political movements in the late 19th century in Europe and into the 20th centuries in Europe. There was the pan-German movement, the Alldeutsche Verband, and the Pan-Slavic movement. And these were both transnational imperialist movements around German and Slavic identity. So one of the themes of her book is that totalitarianism is actually not connected to nationalism. It's connected to imperialism and globalization and globalism. So one of the things that I always having to point out to people is that insofar as one thinks that we have nationalist movements emerging in the United States and Hungary and Russia and Turkey, there's problems around nationalist movements. But from an Arendtian point of view, and I think it's an important insight that she has, totalitarian movements have to be internationalist, have to be imperialist, not nationalist, because they have to create total domination. And nationalist movements are always limited and always create a kind of equality of the citizen as opposed to a racial equality that's pan, that spreads through the world.
I want to ask Margaret Atwood, I've read that we read these novels in times of great change, dislocation in the culture, in the economy, whatever. Why are we attracted to them? Is it because we're afraid of what we might become, or we're looking for some anchorage or something?
I think we're usually afraid of, it's like UNESCO's play Rhinoceros. We're afraid of other people turning into that, and then what will we do? So people of my generation, of course, you probably did it too, Michael. From time to time, you would ask yourself, what would I have done in the war?
That's right.
And yeah. we don't know the answer to that because we were too young. So we weren't actually in it. We were children, but we weren't at a point where we could have done, as it were, anything. But what would we have done? And we just don't know the answer to it. So you put yourself into that situation by reading a book like this, and you think, the choices that the character is making, would I make those choices? Or would I make some other choice?
You mentioned, we look back at that, what would we have done
what
in the war?
What would we have done, exactly.
But these novels, these works, are what will we do?
Yes, but because we don't know what we would have done, we want to know what we would do. And we're not going to get the answer, of course, really out of a book because it's not real life. But it's a way of testing your own potential decisions against the decisions of people caught up in that. So like you, because we are the age we are, you probably have met people who are in various resistance movements.
Yes. Yeah.
And you have probably met people who weren't in various resistance movements. And you probably have read quite a few books about how all of that went down.
Yeah.
And I think really those books come out of that, what would I do? What is a good way to act under these circumstances? And also, how might we avoid ever being in such a circumstance?
Is it your view that Huxley, The Brave New World, is more predictive of whatever dystopian future than George Orwell?
No, not anymore. I think we thought that in the 90s. So Huxley went to Hollywood and was frightened by starlets and underwear. but on the other hand, he thought they were quite nice at the same time. So it's a really different kind of book. I've written an introduction to it. It's another one of those I read as a teenager, and he was very interested in underclothing. Zippy Canucks. What were they? They zipped down the front.
Yeah.
Zippers were new then, so this was a really hot thing, a zipper. So it's a somewhat different kind of book, but when you get to the part, and all of these books always have in them a part where you find out how did it get this way.
Yeah.
So there is one of those in Brave New World, and there was world anarchy and breakdown and horror and catastrophe, and the reason that they put this society together is that at least it's not going to have that.
But everybody is happy.
They are, because they've been engineered to be happy. Now you have to give up any ideas that you might have about literature, tragedy, and the soul, and that's where John the Savage gets into trouble.
Yeah. And you talk about characters who are gene rich and gene poor.
Well, they've been engineered to be so. In Huxley's case, there are giant bottles involved, but I don't think we need giant bottles anymore. And people are thinking along these lines, just so you're aware of that.
Orwell didn't go as far, is that what you're saying?
In a different direction.
Okay.
He created a society in which everybody's miserable and terrified, and kids are egged on to turn in their parents, which they do. So it's much more like Red Guard China or the young pioneers in Soviet Union and like parts of the Nazi society.
How did Gilead come to be? What was the mechanism?
So how did it come to be that we end up with this thing?
A theocracy.
What's my origin story? That's what you want to know. That every society has a foundational mythos, if you like, and one of the ones of the United States, a 17th century Puritan theocracy, on top of which was erected an 18th century deist Enlightenment structure,
right.
Which is right now standing between you and tyranny. So, of course, they would have to get rid of that. So you're Canadian. You remember the suspension of civil rights in the October crisis.
Absolutely.
And the invocation of the War Measures Act.
Yeah.
So you create a crisis, and then you suspend civil rights. And then you have a military coup. And that's happened in country after country after country. So it's nothing new. And I put nothing into the book that somebody somewhere had not already
done.
Done,
I know. Yeah. My guests this morning are Sally Perry, professor of English at Illinois State University. She is the executive director of the Sinclair Lewis Society. Roger Berkowitz, he's the founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities at Bard College in New York. And Ms. Margaret Atwood, the Booker Prize and Giller Prize winning author of dozens of books, including The Handmaid's Tale. I'm Michael Enright. This is the Sunday edition on CBC Radio. Roger, Hannah Arendt said that dictators are not the product of a mob, but of a mass. What did she mean by that?
Yeah, well, it's one of the more complicated aspects. A mob, she thinks, is the lower class people who have particular economic and political interests and have traditional interests, which is that they want power. So she assumes most people in society want power, and the mob is sort of the lower class who are out of power and want power. And to the extent they take power, they are happy. The mass is a very different beast for Hannah Arendt. The mass is not a class. It's formed or it emerges out of the breakdown of classes and the breakdown of interests. And it goes back to what I said about the sort of existential loneliness of modern society. She thinks that that the majority of people in most democracies are not members of any of the classes or parties that exist, but are people who are, in a sense, part of the mass. They have no interests. They have generally are purposeless in their life. And in most normal situations in a country's political life, they don't matter. They're the forgotten people, as you said. But what she says that the early 20th century taught us is that for the first time, we've learned that in certain circumstances, the masses can be politicized. And when they do, they're politicized not around interests. They're politicized around a movement that promises them not that they will satisfy their interests, but that they will make their lives meaningful. Himmler, who Arendt thought understood this as well as anyone, said that the masses are the neutral, politically indifferent people who never join a party and hardly ever go to the polls. I mean, that's Arendt, but she's talking about Himmler. And Himmler says that they don't follow their interests. They're not interested in everyday problems, but only in ideological questions of importance for decades and centuries.
But
and I think the lack of, you know, people say, well, these people are not following their interests. I think that's what's going on. They're the masses.
But they seem to have an implacable sense of loyalty, because there are all kinds of polls now suggesting that the people who voted for Donald Trump, even though they look askance at some of the things he's done in the last 100 and some odd days, 90% of them would vote for him again.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Trump said, you know, a long time ago that he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and he wouldn't lose his support. That, to me, is the essence of his campaign. He actually understands this very well. He's not running a political party or a political campaign. He's running a movement. And in a movement, what he promises is meaning and significance. There's different kinds of people who support Trump. There's racists, there's corporate interests, there's people who maybe think he's going to help the economy. But the core of his support are people who, I think, who feel like political correctness in the United States, or the inability for people to say certain things, the liberal technocratic center model has made them feel unimportant and worthless and even contemptible. The deplorables, as Hillary Clinton called them. And Donald Trump has given them a sense of meaning and importance. And that is much more important than any particular policy or interest. And that's why he can never apologize. He can never say he's wrong, because part of his attraction to them is that he's speaking the truth. He's a truth teller against this lying press and lying technocracy.
Sally Perry, just to carry that a bit forward with Sinclair Lewis, how did he explain the appeal of this strong man, the demagogue, the guy with He's got all the simple answers. You can put them on a bumper sticker. How did he explain his success? Is it something akin to what Roger was saying?
It is, in a sense. I think that there's also an aspect of the sort of charismatic leader connected with that, and whether we're talking about, well, Hitler or Donald Trump. I mean, not only are they giving the people meaning, but in an age when people feel that the country's either going in a wrong direction or that they feel lost, like in the depths of the Depression, if somebody says, I know how to fix this, and, you know, if you'll just, you know, follow me, it might be a little bumpy, but follow me and, you know, everything will work out. And if you say it enough and you say it simply and you have, you know, little buzzwords that people can hang on to, not something complicated, not something that you have to over explain, but something that people say, you know, he's right. He speaks the truth. He's simple. He's like us. Even if he has lots of money, he's still like us. And I think that people who are very afraid are drawn to that because they say, look, somebody will solve our problems.
I wonder, Margaret Atwood, when people are gravitating toward The Handmaid's Tale in whatever form it appears, the treatment of women in the novel and the play and the opera and all that, you have in Washington now a president and a vice president who have made comments about women. Mike Pence is a virulently anti-choice, and we know about Donald Trump's views of women. Does that attract the audience, or do people understand that or incorporate that in their own views?
They completely understand it. I would say the people who are reading it and looking at it are the people who understand it, and the people who are not reading it and looking at it are the people who do understand it, but that's the way they want it to be.
On the right, you mean?
Yeah. That is their thing. I mean, it all comes out of what people said they would like to do if they had the chance. Not the outfits, maybe, but the rest of it. You know, women should be back in the home.
Yeah.
Their purpose is childbearing and all the rest of it. That's been pretty clear for some time.
But it's hard to take Donald Trump as a Puritan fanatic or a Bible literalist.
He's not. And you then have to ask, of the majority of white evangelical Christians, why did you vote for this guy? But because the answer to everything is in the Bible, the answer to that is in the Bible too. God provides imperfect vessels. You know, God provides imperfect implements, like right. Nebuchadnezzar and various other naughty kings who were given power to achieve God's ends. So they see him as somebody who is not their idea of a Christian,
yeah.
But he's going to do their stuff for them.
Roger Berkowitz, what do you think? The words fascist, totalitarian, and so on have been used to describe the Trumpian phenomenon, his style of government. Does he pass your and Hannah Arendt's test for what constitutes a fascist or a totalitarian, do you think?
Well, first of all, those two are different. A fascist is a nationalist who seeks to control the power of the state and do so with the use of force.
Mussolini.
Mussolini right. would be our typical fascist. And a totalitarian is someone who doesn't want to control the state but wants to overrun the state with a party movement that's above the state, and control people's thoughts, whereas a fascist will let people be free at home as long as they are orderly and obey in the streets. So from simply thinking of it that way, there's no way at this point you can think of the United States as either a fascist or a totalitarian country. I think that there are elements of both that send off danger and warning bells in what's going on. The movement element of the Trump movement, which is what I think it is, yeah. is one that is, like all movements, because it provides meaning, it has to deny reality, because reality is always complicated and messy. So you create a fictional, coherent reality which gives people a sense that their lives are meaningful and that they are part of a truthful movement that will create great things. And reality gets in the way, so you deny reality. And there's no doubt that the Trump movement is a reality-denying movement. Just to be fair, I should say that there are many reality-denying movements in the United States today, many of them on the left as well as on the right. The difference is that the Trump reality-denying movement has taken power. But the big difference between a totalitarian movement itself and totalitarianism is whether the totalitarian movement is willing and able to use force and violence to impose its pseudo-reality on reality. Certainly, clearly, at this point, that has not happened. I think the worry that many people have is that in the wake of a terrorist attack or in the wake of a crisis, there will be potentially an opportunity or a desire to do so.
Sally Perry, the novel, It Can't Happen Here, Lewis takes a shot at liberals as well as Buzz Winthrop, the liberal, the editor from Vermont, the guy's name, I've forgotten his name.
Doremus Jessup.
Doremus Jessup. Mm-hmm. Lewis is particularly critical of liberals who seem to have stood by and let it happen.
And I think that's true. I mean, one of the interesting things about Lewis's writing more generally is that many times he's kind of ambivalent, that he sees both sides, and he sees that, you know, he zeroes in on the American character in all its messiness. Yeah, one of the things that comes out is that Doremus Jessup stands for a lot of liberals and progressives who think, well, the government is going along okay, and so, well, you know, I'll vote, but I'm not going to get very involved beyond that because everything is kind of working out. And I think that he and people like him are horrified when they realize that the people that they've kind of ignored or condescended to, there are more of them than they thought. And if they band together, they actually are able to vote somebody into office that becomes a fascist. So, I mean, in a sense, the novel is really a warning to people to stay politically and civically engaged. And, you know, it's, I think, an unexpected byproduct of the election is that there's so many more people who are on the left or Democrats that are involved in a much bigger way, you know, in calling the representatives and marching and doing all sorts of things. And I'm not sure that the supporters of Trump expected that, but it may have a really interesting sort of pushback when it comes to the midterm elections.
He hasn't united the country, but he may have united the Democrats. Is that what you're saying?
I think that very well may be because, you know, I know so many more people who are saying, well, you know, every week I call my congressman or I call my senator or I write a letter or I do something, whereas I think before it was, well, you know, I hear this and it's okay. And I think that a lot of people have been kind of provoked to do more and to ask more questions and things like that.
I want to get a sense from all of you, and I'll ask Margaret Atwood, how accurate or how good is a guide to the future is the literature of the past? Is it a template, or is there a risk that we're going to look for things to confirm the narrative we already read rather than looking for what's going on in front of us?
Well, who can tell? I mean, a lot of people say to me, so you're so prophetic. I said, you know, if I were really a prophet, I would have cornered the stock market years ago.
You wouldn't be sitting here.
No.
You'd be in the Riviera, yes.
You bet. So no, it's not a prophecy. And there is no the future. You know, there are many, many possible futures. So I think we read these kinds of books so that we can at least attempt to avoid them, not so that we will make them come true.
Then is there a sense that we take these works of literature and weaponize them? In other words, use them in whatever our particular cause is to kind of galvanize us to do something?
That is already happening to The Handmaid's Tale. People keep sending me pictures of women dressed up as them sitting in legislatures and, you know, doing demonstrations outside them, you know, particularly when it's a bunch of men deciding about reproductive rights. It used to be that you might see one at Halloween, but now you're seeing them all over the place.
Do you think, Roger and Sally, do you think that could happen in the coming months in the United States, that academics and journalists and people interested in literature will turn more and more to these works to say, look, we can make change?
I know in the case of It Can't Happen Here, I've talked more about Sinclair Lewis in the last couple of months than I have in the last 20 years.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So I think that's true. And I think, as Margaret said, that these novels can give us a sense of what could happen. But on the other hand, it also makes us think. And I think that overall, that's really what the power of literature is, to think and to say, if I were in those shoes, whether we're talking about Gilead or 1930s America, would I have resisted? Would I have collaborated? What would I have done? And, you know, you can use that to sort of think about, in the current situation, what would I do? And I think, at least for many liberals and progressives now, the idea is to become much more politically engaged than perhaps they would have been a couple years ago.
Do you think that's happening with your students, Roger, that people are looking at these texts and these documents and saying, well, wait a minute, I think I can engage with this. I can do something. I can perhaps make a change in my life or something.
Yeah, I think absolutely, Michael. I mean, you know, I teach undergraduates, but I also run a virtual reading group. And we started reading The Origins of Totalitarianism on January 20th, Inauguration Day. And we had the most number of people join in and read it that we've ever had. And, you know, I think there's a difference between people who cite the or buy the book and don't read it, and those who sort of read a couple pages looking for quotes that will support their view to weaponize it, as you said. And then, as Sally just said, you know, those who turn to these books because great works of literature and philosophy are not political weapons. They're spurs to thinking. And there's no way that these books are supposed to be predictors or prophecies of the future. They're attempts to think deeply. That's why they're still read, about what's happened in the past. And I think they offer incredible insights and spurs to trying to understand what's going on now, which I think is different and unique.
Sally, how much faith did Sinclair Lewis have in the democratic process and the strength of the institutions to withstand totalitarianism? Was he an optimist in that?
I think generally. I mean, you know, it can't happen here is sort of a warning. You know, he once rather famously said that, I love America, but I don't like it. And I think that he's very devoted to the goals of American democracy and so forth, but he was also very aware of the imperfections of Americans and how, you know, greed or ignorance or whatnot can lead them in awful directions. You know, you see that with other of his novels like Elmer Gantry and the Rise of the Televangelist.
Yeah.
So it's an ambivalence. I think more optimistic than not, but a lot of his novels are kind of a warning to say, you know, think carefully about what you're doing rather than just sort of amble through life.
Ms. Atwood, I know you love Americans and America and the institutions therein. How much native faith do you have that the democratic culture, constituted, will prevail?
Yeah, I only ever meet the nicest Americans. What do I know? I meet the nice ones,
right,
of course. So I have quite a lot of faith, because America is very diverse, and it has a long tradition of freedom of speech, speaking up, civic participation. I don't think people are just going to roll over for this. I think it would be a lot harder to actually control all America in the way that Hitler controlled all Germany. It's not homogeneous in the way that Germany was. So I have faith in individual Americans to push back, and I'm seeing a lot of pushing back. And when they ask me, because they do quite a bit when I go there, what can we do? I said, well, you might try voting.
Yeah.
And everybody cheers, because we know about the missing Democrats who sat at home.
Mm-hmm. Let me be parochial for a moment. Could it happen here in Canada?
Could it happen here in Canada? It would be, and people ask me that as soon as I published the book, of course, nervous Canadians said, could it happen here?
They apologize first, but then they
sorry,
ask you.
Sorry to ask you this, but could it happen here? It would be harder because, again, Canada is so diverse. And I don't think Quebec would sit still for it, because they had a dose of that under Duplessis.
Yeah.
So that's my theory. But, and also Canada, as you've heard in the song by the Arrogant Worms, Canada's really big. And there's a lot of space between centers of people. So I just think it would be harder to get hold of. Anyway, I'm a screaming optimist, as we all know.
Indeed.
So, but there's going to be some bumps along the way.
Carry on in your screaming optimism. And thank you for joining us and our friends this morning. Thank you, everybody, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to
thank
talk
you
to you. Margaret Atwood is the Booker Prize and Giller Prize winning author of dozens of books, The Handmaid's Tale. You can see the television adaptation of the novel on Bravo. She was with me in Toronto. Sally Perry is the Associate Dean for Academic Programs and Student Affairs at Illinois State University and the Executive Director of the Sinclair Lewis Society. She was in Normal, Illinois this morning. And Roger Berkowitz, he is the founder and academic director of Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities at Bard College. That's on Annandale on Hudson in New York State. You're listening to the Sunday Edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius XM Radio. My name is Michael Enright.